It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new reality competition is bringing 8 drag queens from Wisconsin and Illinois to summer camp for 1 week. We'll get a preview with the co-creator of the upcoming YouTube series. First, CNN reported this week that the TSA at one point was considering eliminating passenger screening at more than 150 small and medium-sized airports across the United States as a cost-cutting measure. The TSA says no decision has been made on the plan, and there's some question over how serious the idea was in the first place. The change would mark a major shift in how airports handle security in a post-9/11 world. Bart Janssen joins us now with more on the story. He's a transportation reporter for USA Today, where he covers the Federal Aviation Administration and the Transportation Security Administration. Bart, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Bart, walk us through this idea. What was being considered here by the TSA?
Well, the TSA has taken a look at this at least since 2011, and each year they go through their budget. They try to see, okay, where might we become more efficient, where might we save costs. And so CNN got some internal documents from a working group that was studying this in June and July that said, well, you know, if they eliminated the checkpoints at 150 of the smallest airports, they could save somewhere in the neighborhood of $115 million a year, and that those airports don't handle very many commercial airline flights or passengers. These would be airports with only planes up to 60 seats apiece, and that handle basically about 10,000 passengers a day. So in exchange for handling 10,000 passengers a day, they staff about 1,300 screeners. So it's a lot of staffing for not very many passengers.
And how serious was this? How far along was this? Or is this something that's kind of out there, people look at it and are shocked, but it probably was never going to happen?
Well, it is not a formal proposal. It is not part of a budget. It is something that they have studied over many years, and so I personally don't think it was, you know, on the verge of happening. If it happens, I will cover it and report on it. But, you know, they are talking about it. It's one thing that they're looking at, and by just studying it, it just sparked a firestorm of criticism from lawmakers and also security experts, saying that they'd be nervous if you all of a sudden pulled up the federal screening at one-third of the airports that they now screen at.
Yeah, in your writing on this, you talked to some security experts. What were some of the concerns that they raised?
Well, there were both financial concerns and security. On the financial side, a few years ago, a guy you might recognize, Paul Ryan, and Patty Murray cut a budget deal in 2012 to avoid a fiscal cliff that diverted some of the TSA ticket fees on each ticket to help reduce the federal deficit. And they do that by about $1.3 billion a year. So if you just allowed the ticket fees to go straight to TSA instead of helping the deficit, you'd have 10 times more money than you have possibly saved by doing this, closing the checkpoints. So that's sort of just the financial side of it. On the security side, what they're saying is, well, it doesn't matter. You don't have to have the largest planes to cause a whole lot of trouble if you're a terrorist. And if it were easier to get on a smaller plane with only 60 seats, you might still be able to do something very bad with that smaller plane. So there's some concern about just removing security from those smaller from the smaller airports. In addition, if you did this, the idea would be that you'd still have to screen those connecting passengers if they flew out of, for example, Rhinelander Oneida County Airport or Eau Claire Chippewa Valley Regional Airports toward larger cities like Milwaukee or Madison, that you'd have to screen the passengers connecting in Milwaukee or Madison, so you'd have to set up a whole new stream of checkpoints and screening within those larger airports, and that could be chaotic and difficult for both airports and airlines. And so that's where you hear both about the security risk, hey, we don't want bad guys to get on planes anywhere, and also just the logistical difficulties of dealing with this if you really went ahead with it.
Talking to Bart Janssen, transportation reporter at the USA Today, talking about a TSA idea, not even a formal proposal, but they were reportedly looking at stopping security screenings for smaller airports around the country, about 150. By my count, it's probably 5-6 airports here in Wisconsin would have been affected by this. Bart, looking at this, do we know, can we look state by state and say this airport would have been affected, this one wouldn't, or was it not far enough along at that point?
My understanding is that it was not far enough along. CNN said they did not have a list of the airports that were actually being mentioned. What I did was look through a list from the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, about the largest 450 airports, and so just looked at the ones from 300 to 450, the smaller ones. And if you assume that they do have TSA checkpoints, then they would be the likely ones. And so two that I flagged for Wisconsin would be that Rhinelander and then the one in Eau Claire. Others around the country would be like Birmingham in New York State, Joplin in Missouri, Waterloo in Iowa. And one of the political facets of this debate, if it were to move forward, is these smaller airports were also the sorts of places that the FAA talked about perhaps closing towers a few years ago, ending the staffing in towers to save money when there was a fight over federal furloughs. And there was a huge outcry about that because people want to continue their airline service. They want people to be able to travel from those smaller cities into larger hubs. And so these are a lot of rural areas, and they're places where a lot of lawmakers in Congress want to defend these, want to continue funding them, whether it's for the air traffic control towers or, in this case, security screening.
Now, not having TSA security at an airport doesn't necessarily mean no security. I learned from your piece there are a handful of airports in the country that don't use the TSA. They have private security. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there has been, Congress created the Transportation Security Administration after the terrorist attacks in 2001. They had been organized locally and essentially paid for by the airlines through the airports. Then it became federalized under TSA. The idea was to have stricter screening, to have federal standards, to have it be tougher to get bad things or bad people onto planes. And in the years since then, there has been some criticism, vocal criticism in Congress about perhaps, abolishing TSA, going back to private screening. Those efforts have not had much success. A big advocate was Representative John Mica, a Republican of Florida. He is no longer in Congress. But so as there have been these calls to perhaps scale back or curb TSA, one of the things that airports can do is petition to hire private screeners instead of TSA. And if TSA approves, then the airport hires this private company that searches the bags, carry-on bags, searches luggage, searches the passengers, just like you see in other airports, but it is a private screener that has to meet TSA standards. So when you walk through the airport, if you're not really looking at the uniforms, it feels very similar to TSA. And these were mostly in a string of smaller airports in like Montana and Wyoming, where they just found there was so little staffing, they just found it easier to hire part-time people like in the morning and in the afternoon when there were rushes, and federal employment laws make it more difficult to shift staffing like that. But there are a couple of large airports, San Francisco and Kansas City, also have private screening. So it's a matter that they turn to this for ease or flexibility in staffing their screening workers, but they still have to meet TSA standards to be able to do that.
Bart, as we wrap up, I've talked to security experts, some, not all, who say, hey, this is security theater. We're paying a lot of money and taking a lot of time for a system that really isn't probably going to catch all that much wrongdoing. Are there still rumblings like that out there? Is anybody in a position to do something about it, saying, hey, we need to rethink the way we're doing these screenings?
Well, there are definitely critics of TSA in Congress. They, as I said, Mr. Mica has left Congress, but you hear that sort of voice every so often during hearings about, how effective is TSA? Is it worth the expense? a lot of the staffing goes toward people that you don't see. You know, you see the blue-shirted people in the airports doing the checkpoints and the carry-on bags, but you don't see things like federal air marshals who are undercover officers that fly on planes with guns to potentially thwart terrorists in the skies. You don't see a lot of the behind-the-scenes screening and just identification checks where they run a background check on people when you buy the ticket to make sure that there's nobody on a watch list or on a database. So part of the difficulty TSA has in communicating why they do a good job is that a lot of what they do you don't see, and you know you don't hear about them finding actual bombs at checkpoints in airports. But you know how much of it is a deterrent, and you know they do find a record number of guns each year. They find you know more than 6,000 guns at checkpoints all around the country. People, you know, not necessarily terrorists, but people bringing many times loaded weapons to the checkpoints that could potentially get on a plane, and they do find a lot of that. So there is criticism that it's security theater, that they aren't very effective, but they do find a lot of stuff, and what they always point to is there hasn't been a similar attack to September 11th since September 11th, and so they are a big part of the reason why that is.
Bart, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks much for having me.
Bart Janssen is a transportation reporter for USA Today, where he covers the Federal Aviation Administration and the Transportation Security Administration. He joined us to talk about the TSA's consideration of a plan that would have eliminated security screening at some of the nation's smaller airports. A new online reality competition is showcasing another side of drag here in Wisconsin. Camp Wanakiki features 8 drag queens spending a week at summer camp competing in outdoor challenges and fashion shows. The goal to be named the Queen of Camp. The show debuts on YouTube on August 7th and includes contestants from Milwaukee, Madison, and Eau Claire. Brandon Wright created and produced Camp Wanakiki along with his brother Ashley. Together, they also co-owned the restaurant chain Hamburger Mary's. Brandon, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, camp here has a double meaning, right? Can you talk about that?
Definitely, definitely. And we're looking for the Queen of Camp, which is literally the Queen of Camp Wanakiki, the TV show that we are producing on YouTube, but also Camp Queens. A campy queen is also known as a comedy queen in the drag world. You've got your glamour queens that are very glamorous, and you got your campy, silly, funny queens. And so we're focusing on those funny camp queens.
And people who don't like puns should steer clear, right? This is going to be puntastic, I imagine.
It's going to be pretty punny, for sure.
Now, how did this idea for Camp Wanakiki come about?
Well, my brother and I, as you said, we own Hamburger Mary's in Milwaukee. And we love drag. We love drag queens. We are huge fans of RuPaul's Drag Race, which is, as you said, is becoming more mainstream. The positive and the negative with that becoming so mainstream is that that's only one side of the drag universe that's being put out there for the masses to see. And we just felt that campy comedy side wasn't really out there. So we were brainstorming and just talking as twin brothers do. One thing leads to another, and we are on this train, and we're like, hey, why don't we do a show with campy drag queens? Hey, why don't we do it at an actual summer camp? Oh, my gosh. What if the queens are in drag doing canoe racing and funny camp activities? So, it was sort of an organic process.
And the show features 8 contestants, as we mentioned, from Illinois and Wisconsin. Can you talk about the cast of characters a little bit that we can expect to meet?
Absolutely. Because it's the first time the show was out there, we had to go with queens that were local because travel was a concern. We've got 2 queens from Milwaukee, Sylvia Nix and Pagan Holiday, 1 from Madison, Vajayjay Snap and Turtle. We have a drag queen from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Dominique DeGrant. We've got several from Chicago, also Alexis Bevels and Muffy Fishbasket, Sekavi and Olasia. If anyone on the northern border of Wisconsin, southern border of Wisconsin, northern border of Illinois, is listening. So they all bring a different something different to the show. They all have their own quirky characters. And it's just a fun time.
And so what kind of competitions are we talking about at this summer camp?
Yeah, so each episode, there'll be seven episodes. Each episode reprises one day at camp. So during the day, the campers are competing in those typical camp activities that, you know, grade schoolers do when they go to summer camp, canoe racing, archery. I don't want to give too much away. But those types of activities are actually physically competing while they're in drag, while they're in character, they're competing in these activities. And then at night, there's a talent show that fits the theme of the day. And the theme of the day represents a badge. So the queens are going for a badge for the day. And then the ultimate badge is the queen of camp, the one that lasts the whole week.
Talking to Brandon Wright, co-creator of Camp Wanakiki. It's a summer camp drag contest, a camp in two meanings of the word. It'll be airing on YouTube soon. I want to give a listen to one of the competitors. You mentioned Sylvia Nix from Milwaukee, reacting to getting picked for the show.
When I first got the phone call saying that I would be coming to camp, I was full of butterflies. I was anticipating, like, everything and nothing all at once. It's a nerve-wracking feeling knowing that you're given an opportunity to show the world the crazy character that you yourself have created.
Seems like everybody has their own unique character and that shaping it is a pretty personal thing. Brandon, on the show and beyond, what goes into finding the character that people want to be, perform as?
Yeah, I think that is even more so for the campy drag queen out there. They kind of fall into a character. And that's what I love about the show also is these queens, and Sylvia mentioned it perfectly, you could be the best campy queen out there and you're never really going to be considered for some of these other programs that are on national TV because they're not really looking for that type of queen. So I'm really proud that we're giving the opportunity for this type of queen to showcase their talents.
And I saw a trailer. The show isn't out yet. It looks like, you know, we're not going to see subtle reactions to the challenges one finds while camping in the wilderness. There's almost like people are really selling it, almost cartoonish, maybe in the moment where you're maybe going to fall off the boat into the water, say.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because the queens were in, well, I keep saying queens, but we like to say campers. the campers were in their character a lot of times, but then they had to, once the challenge began, you kind of see them revert back to themselves because they're like, oh my gosh, now I really have to do this. You know, before it was just my made-up character reacting to doing a canoe race, but oh geez, I'm actually in a canoe now racing against other drag queens in canoes. So it's really funny to see that that character development.
And among the eight contestants here, was there a lot of experience with camping and summer camp activities in drag or not?
It was a mix. I mean, we have some campers that go camping every year, and they were at a slight advantage, one could say, but there's also the talent show at night that was the great equalizer. And then we had some campers that had never been camping at all. So again, you're going to see some people zipping through and having no problem at all, and then some people struggling, which, you know, you never want to see people struggle in real life, but in this situation, it does, you know, it adds some comedic elements to the show.
Now, if you had viewers watching Camp Wanakiki who were unfamiliar with drag performance and the culture around it, what do you want them to take away from watching your show?
Well, you know, first and foremost, I hope it's very entertaining. So we put a program out there that we think is going to be entertaining for people. You know, and then also just the, you know, understanding that there are people different than you and they're doing different things. I mean, we're not really trying to, you know, the point of the program is not necessarily to persuade people's opinions one way or the other. It's just to put a good program out there. But I think by having it and exposing people to it, this art form, because it is an art form when you've created this character and you've developed it, and also some of the skills in actually doing the makeup on the faces is very artistic. So we think there's a lot for people to see, and you know, we know some people aren't going to like it, but we think the vast majority will, if they get a chance to see it, I think they're going to be entertained.
Now, you're not just a producer and a director. You're in the show. You and your brother Ashley, I understand, are drag performers yourselves. Can you talk about your on-camera role in the show?
Yes, we are the camp directors. My alter ego is Cherry Pie. And my brother Ashley, his alter ego is Apple Brown Betty. Together, they're the Sugar Baker twins. So the camp counselors or the camp directors are the Sugar Baker twins. They have their own little comedic sort of role. They're not competing, but they frame the day and the challenges. And we're also assisted by another well-known Milwaukee drag queen, Dear Ruthie, and she is a camp counselor. So you've got two camp directors, a camp counselor, eight campers. They're just hilarious.
I don't want to jump ahead too far here. This is going to air starting pretty soon on YouTube. Is there a series two in the works, or at least in the planning stages?
Well, we'll see how well series one goes. Season one's it's funny because we're always having this fresh on our minds because we just did the filming in May, and then we've been in production ever since, and we're seeing the episodes come to life. We're already in the back of our minds thinking season two, oh, we're going to do this different, we're going to do that, we're going to add this. Like, there's a whole section of camp that we didn't even get to. So we're very hopeful that there will be a season two.
We'll leave it there. Brandon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. And everyone can go to YouTube and Camp Wanakiki.
And that you can find that starting August 7th on YouTube. That was Brandon Wright, co-creator and producer of the YouTube reality show Camp Wanakiki, featuring eight drag queens from Illinois and Wisconsin spending a week at summer camp. 18 years ago, Kevin Nicholson was the president of the College Democrats of America. Today, he's within striking distance of becoming the Republican nominee for Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race. As Sean Johnson reports, the Marine veteran says life changed him, and now he wants to change the federal government.
Some people are quiet about their military service. With Kevin Nicholson, it's nearly impossible to miss. His campaign shirts say, "Send in the Marine." It's printed on the side of his RV. And when he's shaking hands with fellow veterans at the Washington County Fair, he tells them about his service, too.
And I served from 04 to 09 in the Marine Corps. I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's probably, you'd say the same thing, like, not every day was fun, but I would do it over again in a heartbeat.
There's a reason Nicholson stays on this message. For some voters, it works. Navy veteran Alan Peters of West Bend says he's impressed by Nicholson and more likely to support him because he's a veteran.
I like to say no, but if someone did serve in the military, I think I can relate to them a little better.
Air Force veteran Lee Elke of West Bend says he's voting for Nicholson and doesn't care that he was once a Democrat.
It doesn't hurt who you were. It's who you are now. And I believe in him.
Nicholson didn't just vote for Democrats. In August of 2000, he addressed the Democratic National Convention. But he says it was about this time that he started to become disenchanted with politics.
And I saw a Democrat Party that I didn't really like in many different ways. I thought it was obsessed with race, class, gender, ethnicity. And I thought that obsession was going to rip people apart. And it has.
Nicholson says that's when he started to change. He worked as a ranch hand in Wyoming, and it made him more conservative.
And then I came on back, I got married, I joined the Marine Corps, I fought in Iraq in 07, I fought in Afghanistan in 08, 09. I had kids along the way. Every bit of this made me more conservative.
And after the Marines, he went to work as a business consultant. He says that made him more conservative too. Today, polls show Nicholson neck and neck with Republican State Senator Leah Vukmir, a personal friend of Governor Scott Walker with endorsements from the state Republican Party and even House Speaker Paul Ryan. It's not just his personal story that's put him in this position. University of Wisconsin-Madison political scientist Eleanor Powell says that if it weren't for the help of one GOP donor, Nicholson might still be a political unknown.
He would need to have done something to get his name out there. I mean, there are other tactics. You can try to say outlandish things. You can try to get your name in the paper. You know, candidates do all those sorts of things to try to get the attention. But in his case, the money is helping a lot with that name recognition.
Nicholson's biggest financial backer is Illinois businessman Richard Eline, owner of the Pleasant Prairie-based manufacturer Uline. He spent millions on a super PAC to support Nicholson, and it ran TV ads.
Kevin Nicholson, a Marine officer in Iraq, Nicholson completed 100 combat missions.
Eline has also given millions to the Club for Growth Action Fund, and it's run ads too.
President Trump needs fighters in the Senate, fighters like Kevin Nicholson.
The list goes on. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Eline has been one of the nation's biggest GOP donors this election cycle. Beloit billionaire Diane Hendricks is now paying for ads for Vukmir, but she has not spent as much, at least not yet. Nicholson downplays Eline's role. He says he didn't promise him anything he wouldn't pledge to other voters.
We were introduced by mutual friends, and we're friends. We believe that the country has a lot of challenges and that it takes people from outside the political class to deal with it.
Nicholson says the Marines gave him his no-excuses leadership skills and prepared him for all of this. But the self-described political outsider did not get into this fight alone. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Our scheduled guest for this conversation, we're having trouble reaching them, but that gives an opportunity. I want to ask a question that I've been thinking about for a while, and I'm interested in your input and your experiences. I am curious. I'm not very good at making stuff, right? Carpentry or macrame or any of that. I'm pretty bad at all of it. I would like to hear from you about something that you make, something that you create. For money, for fun, maybe a little of both. Call in with what you create, what kind of things you do, what you used to do, and maybe we'll pick up someday, maybe in retirement. I don't know. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share your creative, crafty side with us. What do you make? How do you make it? How did you get into it, by the way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you can even help me find a hobby. We'll get to your calls coming up. Tell us what you make, what you create, how you do it, why you like it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you coming up in just a couple moments here on Central Time. We are looking for your calls. I asked what you like to create, what you craft, how did you get started, what do you like about it? Do you do it for fun and or money? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We have Keegan starting us off in Wapaka. Keegan, hi.
Hi. What myself and my partner do for fun as far as crafting is we paint, and we've actually dabbled a little bit with 3D painting, like 28-millimeter scale miniatures for role-playing games, like Dungeons & Dragons and the such. And we both do it for fun for ourselves, and we do some that we end up selling online.
Oh, really? I have done role-playing games on and off through my life, and I've looked at people doing those painting, these figures. I'd be terrible at it, I think. How did you get started doing this?
We were sitting around, and like you, we were looking at other people doing it, and we're like, oh my God, that is so intimidating. There's so much to it. It's so small. I'm going to mess this up. So we bought a handful of very inexpensive miniatures and some of the lower end paints, and we just tried it. And in reality, you can start for like $20.
And do you have, you and your partner have, an individual figure that you relate to, or that's maybe your character when you play?
She does. I don't.
Okay. All right. You're not that. You don't have that personal connection with anyone.
No.
You love them all.
I generally am running the game.
All right. Keegan, thank you so much for sharing that. We'll go next to Drew on the line in Ashland. Drew, hi.
Hi.
Hi. What do you do, Drew?
I hand make tobacco pipes up in Ashland, Wisconsin.
Okay, how did you get started doing something like that?
I have always been a fan of collecting pipes and woodworking, and I thought, you know, I might as well try making one, and I got the tools I needed, and it's actually been a really fun hobby. So
now, is this a power tool kind of thing, or is this all hand tools you're using?
It's both, actually. You use a lathe, a drill press pretty often, and then there's a lot of hand sanding involved, as well as painting on stain and crafting the acrylic stems. So there's a lot that goes into it.
Now, are you using these mostly as decorative sorts of things, or are these practical things? Somebody could pack it with some Captain Black and use it.
Yes, absolutely, they could. I actually sell them on the side through a just kind of word of mouth, and I've really come to be a part of this community also on Instagram, and so...
Cool. Drew, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. We're asking you to share what you make, what kind of craft you do. Do you do it for fun? How'd you get started? Do you make money, as Drew sometimes does? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Ed is with us in Milwaukee. Ed, hello.
Hello, Rob.
Hi, what do you do, Ed?
I've done watercolors for over 10 years now. I started before I retired, and now that I'm retired, I'm doing it more regularly.
So you started just 10 years ago. Is this something that you used to do in your youth and you picked back up, or was this you came in cold here?
I drew when I was a kid, but this is the first time I started painting 10 years ago, and now I'm doing landscapes, I do commissioned houses, and starting to make some money at it.
That's great. And now, did you start off taking a class, or did you just get the materials and trial and error?
I took a class. I continue to take a class from Linda Lubner in Bayview, and we now have an open studio where we practice and we show our stuff off. And this summer I took a workshop up in Minocqua, and going great guns.
And what's on the canvas right now, Ed?
Couple things. Some houses from Greendale and the Village Hall. It's the that I'll be selling as cards after I reduce them in size. And I've also got some pictures drawn from a novel that I'm fascinated with.
What novel?
Yes, John Hassler's North of Hope has a lot of talk about jack pines in Minnesota. And so one of the works on the easel right now is a scene of jack pines in the fall.
Sounds beautiful, Ed. Thanks so much for calling in. We'll go now to Paul in Trigo. Paul, hello.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hi, what do you make, Paul?
Actually, I produce cribbage boards.
Oh, fantastic.
And I put a wood-burning design on there, sometimes a school logo, sometimes something from nature, but... it's a lot of fun to give them away to my friends that teach elementary school, and they use them to reinforce math concepts, arithmetic concepts with their students. And it's really fun to watch these young rascals developing their competitive edge playing cribbage.
Now, are we talking, you know, your standard rectangular cribbage board, or do you get a little more creative with the shapes?
Well, actually, I like the... instead of the back and forth, it just goes around in a clockwise circle.
Okay.
But it is a rectangle.
And the kids are learning skills like 15-2, 15-4, ain't no more. Learning the math.
Yeah.
The grammar needs to be cleaned up, though.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when they get to the championship round, it's great to see a lot of their friends watching intently and picking up on hints with that. So that's a fun pastime, and it's rewarding to see kids benefit from that.
That's fantastic, Paul. Thank you so much for sharing that. We're taking your calls asking what you craft. What do you make? How'd you get started? What do you like about it? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Kay is with us in Racine. Kay, hello.
Hi.
What are you making, Kay?
Well, one time at Christmas, I didn't have any money for my girls, and so I took a handheld jigsaw and a board, and I cut it up and made doll furniture and painted it and made quilts out of ends of cloth. And so that was really cool, fun for the girls. And what I do now is when I'm going for walks in the woods, I will pull off some wild grapevines that are killing the trees. And then I take them home and make them into a wreath. And then I collect leaves as they're falling in the fall. And I dry them. And then I paint them with acrylic. And then I hot glue gun them to the wreath. And I give them as gifts.
Wow.
And it's called Taking a Walk with Me.
And that's a long-term project. You're constantly watching for those grapevines, and yeah, they can be a nuisance. And it takes months to make this project, it sounds like.
Yes, but it's fun because I'm constantly doing it. So in the summertime, I'm pulling grapevines off, and then in the fall, I collect all the leaves and dry them in books, and then I get them with acrylic, and then I give them out at Christmas time.
Now, how many are in the works right now?
Oh, I probably have 10.
Okay.
Hanging that I've got already ready to go.
That is
and
great.
And I have some leaves left over from last year, so I'll be painting those with acrylic and putting those on, and it's fun.
Okay, thank you so much for telling us about that. We'll go next to Chris in Mineral Point. Chris, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Chris?
Well, I hand-stitch baby quilts. In other words, I don't use any machine whatsoever. I just hand-stitch the whole thing.
Okay, baby quilts, how big are we talking here? Well, baby size, obviously.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I would say there probably could be up to like 5x5 or down to like 4x4.
Where did you learn to stitch?
My grandmother used to make these beautiful bed quilts by hand. She'd stitch them, and she was getting too old to get on the floor to make the base stitch to keep it together. So it's just one of those you just, you know, kind of learn from the elders, and I just kind of picked it up. It's kind of fun, very therapeutic.
And I imagine some people have gotten some pretty nice presents, shower presents.
Yes, they have. You know, and I don't charge them, and I don't sell them. I just make them, and, you know, they're like, oh, I'll hang them on the wall. And it's like, no, use them. You know, they'll withdraw or handle anything.
Chris,
you know, wash or what have you.
That sounds great. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We heard from Jennifer. Jennifer emails, I create scale mail. It's derived from chain mail, all those tiny linking rings that knights wore way back when. In place of some of the rings, I use sort of leaf-shaped pieces of metal with a hole punched in them. They're linked together along with some of the rings in regular chainmail. They look like dragon or fish scales, all colors, sizes, and metals. Jennifer says, I used to sell it, but I'm on hiatus right now as I just had a baby. I don't know if there's a market for baby-sized scale mail. Maybe. I don't know. Thank you for telling us that story, Jennifer. Let's go back to your calls now. We're asking what you make, what your craft is. We'll go to Mark in Three Lakes. Mark, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you do, Mark?
I'm a tinker.
A tinkerer. So what kind of stuff do you tinker with?
Anything I get for free.
Okay, so you find maybe stuff on the roadside or somebody gives you something,
well,
and then what's the tinkering process?
Well, let's see. I got an 11-horse lawnmower that I got for free. I put it back together, and I've been using it for the last 11 years. That's called recycling.
Okay.
And I pretty much live in that world that there is all kinds of things out there because we live in a throwaway society that you can find and rebuild or reuse hard-to-find parts, but life goes on.
Yeah, so what happens if you have that lawnmower, Mark, and there's this key part that you don't have, or whatever the project is? Are you able to craft your own parts?
Yes, I am a certified machinist and welder.
Okay. That's great. How did you get started in that, Mark?
Well, I started because I needed to, how can I put it? As a kid, I made mini bikes and go-karts and sold them. That's how I made money. Then when I got my own cars, I learned how to work on them and build them and or fix them. And after that, you know, once it got to the computer age, I'm sort of like a dinosaur now. I'm over in the 60s, so life goes on.
And so does the lawnmower. Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that story. That's great. We'll go next to Corky with us in Madison. Corky, hi.
Hi, Cor. Thanks for taking my call. And I make a dog walking tool. Came to be out of necessity. It catches the dog waste before it hits the ground, and then I can empty the contents down the toilet and flush the contents away and reuse the bags if they're not soiled.
And does the dog need some kind of training to work with you and make sure it's using the tool properly?
I think most of the training would go into the dog walker. And encourage mindfulness in dog walking and be aware of that dog's body language when it's going to go and when that sphincter is committed to relief. You put the basket under the rump and let it go.
All right. Are a lot of people using these out on the streets now, Corky?
I just started to sell them, and I want to start selling them online as well, so I have to learn about using credit card or, you know, all the financial stuff online.
Well, good luck with that, Corky. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We're asking what you make, what you craft. We'll go next to Kate in Sussex. Kate, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. As I was listening to your program, I was grinding zucchini to make sweet zucchini pickle relish, which is something that I make several batches each year.
And are you making fridge relish, or are you canning it proper style?
It gets canned. I can it. So.
And now I do a zucchini relish that I love. I found a recipe online. I'm too lazy to can for real, so I'll just do a few in the fridge. What are some of the key ingredients in your zucchini relish that I can steal for mine?
zucchini, cucumbers sometimes, green pepper, red pepper, and onion. And then, of course, you know, some sugar and stuff when I'm canning it.
Okay.
That's funny. I didn't know. The recipe that I have was one that was given to me if I promised not to share it.
Uh-oh.
It was from the Old Order Brethren in Indiana. And we lived in a town where the standing joke was the only time you needed to lock your car was when zucchini were in season because otherwise you'd come home and find your car full of zucchini.
Thank you so much, Kate. I think there was a secret ingredient you might have left out, so you didn't share the whole recipe. Time for another call or two. Cindy is with us in Lake Mills. Cindy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you make, Cindy?
I make all kinds of things. I make padded photo albums and picture frames. I make barrettes out of beads, keychains out of beads, and I love doing it with my grandchildren.
Oh, cool. Cool. And do you find just cool little rocks and pebbles to add in there?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do, especially in the barrette. You know, my granddaughter has very long hair, and we enjoy making them for her a lot.
Great. So. Cindy, not a great connection there. Thank you for sharing that. A quick call. Tiffany is with us in La Crosse. Tiffany, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to share a hobby that I recently picked up the last couple years. A friend and I, we actually crochet to donate items to those in our community that, you know, are in need. So, like, crocheting scarves, hats, and mittens.
And then you donate it to, do you go through an organization?
Actually, no. This past winter, we actually just went to our local park, and we did that, you know, take the scarf if you're in need and tie it to a tree type of thing.
Oh, neat.
I know right now that it's a little warmer, we are crocheting items like cat beds and dog pads for the animal shelter.
That's great, Tiffany. Thank you so much. That's a great project that you and your friend are doing. Thanks to everyone who shared your crafts. I'm always curious about people who are actually good at doing stuff, unlike a certain radio host I could name. You can keep sharing your stories. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Love to hear more of your craft stories. On a sort of related note, it's National Coloring Book Day, and grown-ups are invited to play along. Coloring books have been on the rise in recent years as a relaxing pastime for adults. The National Coloring Book Day website lists regularly scheduled coloring parties for grown-ups, including 7 at Wisconsin libraries. J. Carlisle Larson has done some coloring in her day. Hey, JC.
Hello. Yes, I have, both as a child and now as an adult. I find it, you know, as you just said, very relaxing.
Yeah. How do you start coloring maybe music on in the background? What's going on?
Yeah, it's just you kind of the way my house is set up, I'll sit on the floor, maybe use my ottoman to do it just as a way to chill out. Usually my cats are very excited to see what I'm up to because they're like, oh, something is moving around. I'm going to attack.
I've seen geometric patterns in these grown-up coloring books, scenes from movies and books. Do you have a preference?
No real preference, just whatever looks kind of cool, I guess. I should be a little bit more jazzed about it because I like it, but no, I'm pretty, I'm into whatever.
Not too picky. Were you good at coloring as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Very good.
I was not. I think that's why the grown-up coloring phase hasn't gotten to me, because it's maybe bringing back, you know, I'm not going to say traumas exactly, but I was...
You don't want to revisit your childhood.
I couldn't stay in the lines. Not because I was a rebel, just because I was terrible. I was terrible.
Well, I stayed too much in the lines about that.
JC, thanks a lot. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.